So we are finishing the first three parts of this. We'll finish in this lesson. And we have been talking about a lot of science and faith, science and religion, because, and we will move past that to some extent after this, but the beginning of Genesis, Genesis chapter 1, talks about, in our first lesson, we talked about the creation of the universe, the world, the universe as we know it. We talked about the biblical account is creation from nothing. God speaks the universe into existence. It is the only view, by the way, that answers the question, where did matter come from? Then we looked at some of the scientific theories. We looked at the steady state theory. We looked at the Big Bang theory. And then we also looked at an up-and-coming multiverse theory. So of different scientific ideas, very different from each other, very contradictory, but different scientific ideas about where the universe came from. In our last lesson, we moved on in the Genesis creation account to the creation of life. We talked a little bit about evolution and faith, and we will continue in this lesson. I want to focus on human origins. And so we're going to move beyond life, and we're going to go to another level of life, if you will. We want to talk about the beginnings of humanity. One of the things that's coming out here is, if you're listening to the subtext of what's happening as we talk about this, you realize it's not so simple as faith versus science. In fact, that is a false dichotomy. If you get nothing else out of this first section, I want you to realize that faith and science are not opposed to one another. As a matter of fact, I'll give you a couple of quotes. James Clerk Maxwell, by the way, lived in the 1800s. If you are a physicist, quantum mechanics, mathematician, you have studied his work. Giant of the field. His electromagnetic equations are still used. He was a precursor to quantum mechanics and the theory of relativity. A giant in the field. He is not alone. There are more and more Christians at the top echelons of science. So what I want you to realize is that science and faith are not actually in opposition. It seems that way, but listen to what he had to say. I think men of science, as well as other men, need to learn from Christ. And I think Christians whose minds are scientific are bound to study science so that their view of the glory of God may be as extensive as their being is capable of. This continues a long, long chain, all the way back, back further. But Sir Isaac Newton, the great discoveries in science have traditionally, not exclusively, traditionally been made by Christians. Science and Christianity have not really been in opposition until recent times. Alvin Plantinga made this observation. This is very, very astute. There is a superficial conflict between science and faith, theistic religion. It's a superficial conflict, but there's deep agreement between science and faith. That's interesting. Listen to what else he said. There is a superficial agreement between science and naturalism, but there's actually a very deep conflict between the two. Science is a methodology in the pursuit of knowledge. Naturalism is a belief system. Naturalism is the belief system that everything that occurs can be explained and is caused by what you can see. In other words, matter and energy. There's nothing beyond that. That cannot be proved. That is an article of faith. And so what Plantinga is saying is that there, it seems like that makes sense, that science only works with matter and energy. But when you get a little deeper, you realize that doesn't work so well. And I'm going to give you two examples so as not to get too technical, but one is the multiverse. We talked about that. The idea of the origin of our universe is that the up-and-coming idea now, because scientists need to get rid of, when I say scientists, atheists, need to get rid of that Big Bang. That's just way too much like Genesis. So multiverse, you have an infinite number of universes, and so creation doesn't really have a start. And so multiverse is not testable. It's not, doesn't fit with naturalism very well. It sounds more like science fiction. And it begins to sound like maybe there's more than this universe. And in fact, the multiverse says, well, actually, there are an infinite number of universes out there. Can't see them, can't test it, can't access them, but they're out there. See, that's one way. I'll tell you another one that's you may or may not have heard of, but this is fascinating. Quantum entanglement. And this is just one of many things. What quantum entanglement is, briefly, you have two particles, and they are separated from each other by space. They're not together. They share a quantum state, and so what happens to one happens to the other. That looks like magic. Now, I'm not telling you that science isn't pursuing this. The fact that you have a label for it, it's called quantum entanglement, do not make the mistake of thinking that anyone understands it. It's just been labeled. And I want you to be careful about that. I'm not being anti-science. I'm just saying when you put a label on something, you doesn't mean you understand. There is no explanation for this, but it is pretty cool. It is basically what happens to something here happens to something there simultaneously. That's quantum entanglement. Now stop and think about that for a minute. That really, really gets outside the bounds of traditional assumptions in science. So I'm not saying science shouldn't pursue that. I'm just telling you that Planting is right. Superficially, there seems to be a conflict between faith and science, but the deeper you get, the more you realize maybe there's more to this universe than we realize. That's true in the quantum world, and you're going to see in a little bit, it's also true in the biological world. So if you get nothing else out of this first part, I don't want you to think that science and faith, that old science or faith, you do not have to make that choice. And as a matter of fact, the more science that gets done, I would argue the closer these are going to get. See what you think by the end of this lesson. So let's talk about specifically the origin of humans. Some of this is the same as the origin of life, but I want to take it a little different direction. So there are four basic views of the origin of human beings. The first is creationism. This is the biblical account. And it says that God exists and God created humans. And I'll talk a little more about it in a minute. Darwinian evolution, there is no God, of course. Life evolved from simple to complex organisms by random mutation and natural selection. Intelligent design says there may or may not be a God, but evolution cannot proceed by random mutations and natural selection. It shows signs of being guided in some way. Intelligent design. And fourth, theistic evolution. There is a God, and he guided evolution. So four very interesting ideas, and I want to look at each one of them briefly, and then I want to talk to you about some pros and cons, because I want us to understand this landscape. So first, here's the Genesis account in Genesis 1 of the creation of human beings. And God said, "Let the earth bring forth living creatures according to their kinds, livestock, creeping things, beasts of the earth, according to their kinds." This, on its face, precludes the idea of evolving creatures. I want you just to read it. What it says, the plain sense of the text is, God created creatures of its kind. Now, we talked about microevolution in our last lesson. That's a fact. I don't have any issue with that whatsoever. But one species turning into another species, you don't see that here. Okay. So, and it was so. God made the beasts of the earth according to their kinds, etc., etc. Then God said, "Let us make humanity in our image, after our likeness, and let humanity have dominion over the fish and the birds, the heavens, the livestock." And so now you get the creation of human beings, and they are different in some sense. They are qualitatively different. They're made in the image of God, and they have dominion over the other creatures. This is very different than an evolutionary point of view. So that I just want you to understand what is this text actually saying. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. That's just Hebrew poetry. Male and female, he created them. And God blessed them. He told them, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, have dominion over the fish of the sea. God said, behold, I've given you every plant yielding seed that is on the face of the earth, and all of it will be for food. And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. And this was the sixth day. This is the end of biblical creation. Seventh day is the day of rest, you see as you move into chapter 2. So just some observations. This is sometimes called this creationist view, biblical view, sometimes called special creation, meaning God created human beings, specifically Adam and Eve. We'll get to that in a little bit. God created human beings as human beings. So that's sometimes you'll see this in the literature called special creation, meaning didn't create something that turned into a human being, created a human being. That's creationist point of view. The other thing I just want you to notice, because I want to contrast some things as we move through, because there's some very interesting implications to this later. One is, this is very personal. You have a personal God creating individual humans. Hold that thought. You're not going to see it again, okay, in the rest of these views. Very personal, very meaningful. And you notice that in the creation of humanity is built in a purpose. Like, I didn't create you to set you on a shelf and look at you. I created you to join me in work, in meaningful things to do. So it's personal, it's meaningful, and there's a purpose. Human beings are created in the image of God. This is the foundation. This sentence, that phrase, is the foundation for all of human rights in the Western world. Every theory of human rights goes back to that, is the idea that what makes humans have worth. That question is very difficult to answer without this. In fact, it's almost impossible to answer. And as you look at other cultures who don't believe in God, you'll realize that their answer is that human beings do not have innate value or worth. All of our concepts of human rights go back to this. And then, if you think about, for in America particularly, all people are created equal. All men are created equal. All people are created equal. Why do you say that? That's so obviously not true. In this sense, people are not created in equal ability, equal intelligence, equal good looks, equal height, equal weight, equal anything, right? In what sense can you say that and it's true? Only in this sense. That's why you will not see that sentence in any other culture's constitution. Does that? I don't know if you've thought about this. I just want you to realize this goes back to this point of view. Okay? So that's creationism. That is basically reading the Bible, and it says, I believe what it says. God did what this text says. Neo-Darwinian evolution. I call it neo-Darwinian because no one believes Darwinian evolution anymore. I mean, just the standard old origin of species, you know, the ascent of man. No one actually believes that to be correct. It's been modified heavily since that time. So I call it neo-Darwinian evolution. So what does it say? It says, and I purposely didn't use the word human beings, because you actually have an extremely difficult time knowing what a human being is if you're an evolutionist. So instead, I just used Homo sapiens, which is a particular species. Homo sapiens originated by gradual, unguided evolutionary processes, specifically survival of the fittest, acting on mutations, small mutations over a very long period of time. That chart happens to be the current thinking. It has changed, of course, the current thinking on the different species that led to Homo sapiens. But this is the neo-Darwinian view. What I want you to realize about it is extremely impersonal. This is random mutations and survival of the fittest. There's nothing personal about this. It's extremely mechanistic. In other words, evolution is attempting to define mechanisms that, and it's a theory, might explain how humans got here. And the mechanism is mutations. Every now and then one of them is favorable, and hopefully natural selection propagates it. So you need a ton of time for this to happen, and you need a ton of faith. But fundamentally, Darwinian evolution is trying to describe a mechanism that might explain the appearance of Homo sapiens. There is no meaning here at all. If this is true, then there, and I'm not saying this to be accusing evolution of anything, this is just baked into evolution, is there is no meaning in your life. There is no meaning greater than survival. Now, you may want to introduce meaning into it, and believe me, everyone wants to. Not many people are bold enough to walk around and say, I got here by accident, my life has no meaning, whatever I do makes nothing, no difference, and by the way, I'm fun to talk to at parties. No one wants to live their life like that, and the history of humanity under this point of view is the illusion of coming up with some sense of meaning. For those of you that are philosophy majors, this is the essence of the philosophy of existentialism. So Camus and Sartre, etc., the precursor of postmodernism. That is essentially what that whole product is all about. Matter of fact, okay, I realize I'm off track, but this is a brilliant little quote. So a brilliant little quote from Camus, which says, there's only one real philosophical problem, and that is suicide, meaning why should you not kill yourself? That is not a happy philosophy, people, okay? That is answering this problem. Think of the 1900s, Darwin in the 1800s, they're grappling with this issue. If evolution is true, there is no meaning, and so you need to make it your project to somehow find meaning. Okay, enough said about that, but I want you to see some contrast. Needless to say, nobody loves that point of view, and that's what's going to spawn the next two views. But before we get there, I want to talk to you about this idea of evolution. This is from this is an opponent of evolution, but very big zoologist and geneticist. He said, evolution is a theory that is universally accepted, not because it can be proved by logically coherent evidence. We talked in our last time that there are challenges to evolution. There are some significant challenges to that theory. But because the only alternative, special creation, believing the Bible, is absolutely incredible. And so not all science, I'm not telling you that all evolutionists believe in evolution just because they don't want to believe in the Bible. But I am telling you this, evolution, most average intelligent people, I'm going to show you a chart that is going to shock you in just a little bit, but listen to me now and you'll know why I say this. Most average intelligent people accept evolution as true. You got taught that in school, you got taught that in college, you can be cast out of the scientific, out of universities if you don't agree with it. Almost every average intelligent person accepts evolution, and very, very few average intelligent people really believe that this is all random. Evolution is the most widely accepted, I just think this is hilarious. Evolution is the most widely accepted theory that almost nobody actually believes. Does that make sense? But that's true. I mean, it is widely accepted, but no one really believes it. I'll show you the stats on that in a minute. And there's a reason for that, because the more you get into it, the more you realize that evolution is, that life, particularly human life, way more complex, way more involved than evolution could possibly imagine. These are two recent quotes from, these are not Christians, these are evolutionists. Living cells do not operate blindly. This is Shapiro from University of Chicago. Life requires cognition at all levels. Back the truck up. I mean, this is a Darwinian evolutionist, but what you see as you get into this is his point is, oh no, cells are far more complicated and do far more stuff than you would think. In fact, his point is, it's almost as though cells make decisions. This is not a niche idea. This is what you're going to start to see, and this is, you see a lot of it. I just quoted two, because my wife said, don't overdo this, Terry. So I'm just quoting two here. The next one is from Barbara McClintock. She founded the field of cytogenetics. This is her Nobel Prize acceptance speech. Listen to this. Some sensing mechanism must be present to alert the cell to imminent danger. The conclusion seems inescapable that cells are able to sense the presence in their nuclei of ruptured ends of chromosomes and then activate. Charles Darwin's rolling over in his grave. Cells don't activate. They don't act. We random mutation and natural selection. I just want you to see how far past that evolutionary biology has come. Then they activate a mechanism that will bring together and unite these ends. The sensing devices and signals that initiate these adjustments are beyond our present ability to explain. A goal for the future might be to determine the extent of knowledge the cell has. I don't know if you remember much of your evolutionary training in college or anything else. This is, it's a whole other universe. This sounds more religious. Now, I'm not trying to debunk evolution. I just want you to understand, evolution is not what you've been taught. And that's not where the state of the science is. This sounds like, wait a minute, there's some kind of intelligence going here. He says, we know nothing, however, about how the cell senses danger and instigates responses to it. This is way beyond DNA. This is way beyond the simplistic idea that you've gotten. So my point to you is that there are a lot of problems with neo-Darwinian evolution. Science has moved on and is trying to adapt that theory to take in a lot of very, very new and very difficult evidence. That is why the next two theories have really gained traction. So if you set aside the Bible for a moment, say, I don't want to believe in God, I don't want to believe the story of the Bible, but I've got major heartburn with Darwinian evolution. It does not seem to be capable of explaining. The more we learn, the less it seems to explain it. So then you get a certain group of scientists who come in this intelligent design movement. There are more than the Discovery Institute, but if you want to know more, the Discovery Institute's a good place. These are all credentialed scholars. This is a reaction that says, look, evolution clearly doesn't explain this entirely, and so intelligent design is the view that certain features of the universe and of living things are best explained by an intelligent cause rather than undirected processes such as random mutation. And in other words, it sure looks like there's some intelligence involved to guide this thing. Now, intelligent design believes in evolution, the movement of creatures from one to another. It simply says that Darwinian evolution, randomness will not get you there. There must be some intelligence guiding this. Intelligent design stops short of saying what that intelligent designer might be. So it's not theistic. It doesn't believe, now some of these people may believe in the God of the Bible, but that is not what intelligent design is. It does accept evolution, and this solves some of the problems that I talked to you about, irreducible complexity, like how do you get one change after another randomly and get an eye? They're like, you don't, but maybe somebody out there is guiding this process to get an eye. We'll get this change and we'll hold it. And then we'll get this change and we'll hold it. Then we'll get this change and now we have an eye. Does that make sense? That's intelligent design. So intelligent design is not the God of the Bible. It is somewhat impersonal because it's more deistic. It just says there's some intelligence out there. Little green men, a God, who knows, who cares? I'm just arguing that there's some intelligence here. Intelligent design is hated by both of the other two points of view. Okay? If you're a Christian, intelligent design isn't Christian enough. And if you're Darwinian, it's too Christian. They just don't get invited to anybody's Christmas party. So intelligent design is a scientific initiative to try to shore up or rebut some of the problems with evolution. Finally, theistic evolution. And this point of view says the God of the Bible created life, including humans, through evolutionary processes. And I put the word natural in there, meaning through mutations, survival of the fittest, but the God of the Bible reached in and put his thumb on the scale and tweaked things, guided this, but used the evolutionary process to do so. It's called theistic evolution. So God, this is a statement from BioLogos. Francis Crick, who was former head of the Human Genome Project, is probably one of the great proponents of this, and he's the founder of the BioLogos Institute. I only put that on there, not because I recommend it, but if you want to know more about this view, BioLogos is where you go. Their statement is, God created all living things through Christ using intentionally designed, remember that's different than Darwin. Darwin said unguided processes. No, this is guided process. Actively sustained natural processes, that's evolution, that scientists today call evolution. So theistic evolution, you get to have the God of the Bible, and you get to harmonize the God of the Bible with the current scientific theory, evolution. You have some of the same problems with macroevolution. Still hard to understand how through natural processes one species becomes another species. So you do have some problems. And so theistic evolution is extremely popular because you get sort of the best of both worlds. And consequently, this is my description of theistic evolution. This works as long as the boat doesn't get too far from the dock, okay? So I'm being facetious, but my point to you is that theistic evolution says I want a God, but I accept the scientific consensus about an evolutionary process happening. And as long, and they do not see those two in conflict. I agree with that part. It's not necessarily, science is not in conflict. Some of the assumptions of evolution, sure, your assumptions are wrong. But that basically trying to have a foot in both worlds. Does that make sense? Those are your four major views of how human beings got here. So I'll bet your next question is, I wonder what most people believe. This is very surprising. This is I'm just talking about America. This is a 2024 Gallup poll, so it's very recent. But look at this. Creationism is about 33%, if I remember the number. About 33% of Americans believe the biblical account, special creation. God created Adam and Eve, created human beings as human beings. Theistic evolution, about 34% of Americans would like to have a foot on the dock and a foot on the boat. Like, I do think there's a God, but man, oh man, you know, if I don't answer this test right, I'm going to flunk biology. You know, so you got evolution, but it's theistic evolution. This is surprising. Look at how many people believe in basically evolution without God, Darwinian evolution. Now you're down to, as I recall, 27%. That's why I said to you, evolution is widely accepted, but no, almost nobody believes that it's random. And that is what the stats tend to show. So you basically get 67% of people in America think there's a God, but you get 61% of people think that he used evolution, the evolutionary process to get here. Does that make sense? Okay, those are basically your four views. Now what I'd like to do is I'd like to tease out some of the implications of these views, because what you believe about origins matters. That's true in all areas of life, but what you believe about the origin of human beings has huge consequences. And I want to show you that, because I don't know that that's intuitively obvious. You may think, well, whether I believe in evolution or whether I believe in the Bible or if I'm theistic evolution, does it really matter? Here I am, I'm here and I'm living my life. I want you to think a little bit longer and a little more deeply about that, because it makes a huge difference. But let me take one issue for, I've got three more questions. First question though is, we got to talk about Adam and Eve. Okay, so, because this is going to come up, so we might as well talk about it. What about Adam and Eve? So creationism, you have special creation. Adam and Eve were created as fully formed human beings. Think Ken and Barbie, okay? So, I mean, they look like human beings. They're created like human beings, that God created them in the image of God, okay? The other three theories have major problems with Adam and Eve and really reject this idea. The Darwinian point of view says there is no such thing as Adam and Eve. You just have hominids, right? These various species, and one day you get some Homo sapiens and off we go. And that's all she wrote. There is no progenitors of the human race. Intelligent design also believes in evolution. But intelligent design says, since there's some intelligence in this, that it may be that God, out of all these hominids, that God chose a specific pair and said, you two are going to go to the prom, you're Adam, you're Eve, and I'm going to use you. Theistic evolution says God, that there are all these hominids. Okay, so theistic evolution is like I say, you got one foot on the dock and one foot on the boat. So you don't think Adam and Eve were created special. You just think they evolved. And at some point, there's these hominids, right? These Homo sapiens. And God chose two of them to covenant with. Now, you're probably sitting there thinking, if you're a creationist, you're thinking to yourself, man, that is hard to fit in the biblical account. Indeed, it is. But it fits very nicely with evolutionary theory. So the way this kind of comes around, so if you're intelligent design or theistic evolution, what you really want to say is that Adam and Eve weren't real people per se. They were sort of an idea of the progenitors of the human race. And this is where you get this young lady called mitochondrial Eve and this guy called Y-chromosomal Adam. So it is thought that there was a female Homo sapiens, and every woman alive today can trace her genetics back to that one. Not because she was the only one created, it's just all the other lines died out. So that all women today do indeed have at least one common ancestress. They believe that she is currently, she looks awfully good for this, about 200,000 years old. That about 200,000 years ago in the evolutionary process, her kids and their kids and their kids and their kids were so successful they never died out, and every woman here is descended from this one person. This is the theory. Same with Adam. Adam's a little older, 260,000 years ago, it is thought that there was one man who every man alive today is descended, genealogically descended from his chromosomes. That makes sense? There's a lot of patterns out there, but everybody gets his. So this is as good as it gets for Adam and Eve if you have evolution in your toolbox. Make sense? This is a bit of an issue, and Tim Keller says it really well. He says, look at 1 Corinthians. Paul says this, death came through a man, the resurrection also comes through a man. In Adam all die, talking about Adam, the first man who committed a sin and all of humanity fell. But in Jesus, all will be made alive because of his obedience. Keller says it this way, if Adam doesn't exist, Paul's whole argument that both sin and grace work covenantally falls apart. You can't say that Paul was a man of his time, but accept his teaching about Adam. If you don't believe what he believes about Adam, you're denying the core of Paul's teaching. And so I simply what I'm trying to tell you here is that if you accept the Bible as it is, you have some problems in that it seems to be at odds with some of the current scientific thinking about evolution. I get that. But if you don't, and you accept evolution, you have a hard time accepting some of the rest of the Bible. Does that make sense? So you've got to pick your poison here. There are difficulties either way. So those are the four views, the four major views, and that's kind of where Adam and Eve shake out. Okay? All right, two more questions. And this is where you get the idea that origins really matter. I want you to look around at our world, and I want you to think about it for a minute, and you're going to see the repercussions of these points of view. I just picked two, and the first one is, what about morality? This may be a little less true with theistic evolution, but anything that has evolution, fundamentally, human beings are animals. It's a famous thing, the naked ape. This Desmond Morris's point, and his point was, is that human beings are simply more evolved animals. And the morality of that is radically different than anything you want to live in. And that is that the law of the jungle is the law of humanity. Now you may say, well, that's not exactly true. And I would say, watch the news. We don't want it to be true. But if you believe this, this is your world. Richard Dawkins, and this has been very much debunked by evolutionary biologists now, but the idea that genes control your destiny, that genes want to replicate themselves. I showed you those quotes earlier. Did you see anything about genes in that talk about cells? Genes don't do much. I mean, it is genetics, but genes are not what are really moving the needle in evolutionary biology. Nevertheless, the point is that you have this mechanistic way of being and that we are simply animals. And the problem for morality comes down to this. What does one animal owe another animal? Nothing. There is no goal higher than the will to survive. This is very much recognized throughout history. Thucydides, all the way back in circa 4th century BC, said this, "The strong do what they will, and the weak suffer what they must." Very good evolutionary world. Nietzsche in the 20th century, "The will to power. Morality is for weaklings. All that matters is power." And this is a very evolutionary idea. I mean, it's extremely consistent. The problem with it is when it comes to morality is morality becomes very much what is useful to me and my survival, or more actually, you and I don't struggle to survive, we struggle to prosper, don't we? What's useful? Guess what's not useful? Babies, old people, handicapped. Any society that is fundamentally based on an evolutionary idea, and ours is more than you would think, look around, you will see its morality played out in the way it treats the weakest people in its society. There are implications to evolutionary beliefs. And one of the implications is that at the end of the day, human beings are not created in the image of God. They are not special. They are special insofar as they are useful. Does that make sense? Just think about our culture. That is the impact of evolution. There's a war in our culture because Christians don't think that. So you might say, but wait a minute, there's other things. Yes, there are. There's a war going on. But to the extent you see our culture's attitude toward those groups of people, very, very good evolutionary thinking. Morality is a major implication. Euthanasia, abortion, the dignity of different ethnicities, racism, all very, very comfortable in evolution. I'm not trying to smear this, but I'm just saying if you believe in Darwinian evolution, racism is not a problem at all. It's survival of the fittest. So again, I'm not trying to smear people. I'm just telling you, you know where all this comes from? It comes from that ideology. What you think about our origins matters. Question.
Going back to the text in Genesis, when it says that God created in our image, what is the "our" referring to?
So the word there is plural. And there are several thoughts. So I'll give you three thoughts. One, and no one knows why that word is plural there, but it is, and it's used that all through chapter one. I mean, it's very consistent. So Elohim, the word gods, but we translate it God because that's what it's talking about. One would be the editorial we, right? Like, you know, royal we. That's really common in royal proclamations. We have decided that this is going to happen. Who? The king. So that's one possibility. Another possibility is it is God speaking with the angels, the other heavenly beings. Let us create them in this image. The third possibility, which is a Christian idea, not a Jewish idea, is that this is the Trinity, that our God is three in one. And this is the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit together. It's entirely possible that that's the case. No one actually knows, though, why that. But those are three ideas. So that's why you'll see that.
Okay. In Genesis chapter 1, it says, "In the image of God, he created him, male and female." And then in chapter 2, it says, "He created Eve." So what's up?
Well, okay, so I wanted to take that into the whole idea of the Hebrew words there for men and women, male and female and all that, but I don't know if that's where that question wants to go. Is that question just want to know where did Eve come from?
It's just talking about that there's actually two narratives of creation.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, okay. So in chapter one, I didn't go into chapter two, but chapter two is a drill down, and it gives you more detail about the creation of humanity. So that's, some would argue, this is not a strong argument in my view. Some would say several people wrote Genesis and chapter one is one creation story and chapter two is another creation story. Yeah, it's just read it. You'll realize this is not two stories. There isn't a creation of the universe in chapter two. Chapter two is all about human beings, okay? And so it goes into a little more detail. So you get the creation of humanity, the creation of Adam, whose name comes from ground. Adama means dirt, ground. And so he's created out of the ground and he's called Adam. Think about it like this. His nickname is Dusty. Okay, that's what that basically means. Then you get the male and female, which are two different Hebrew words, which talk about gendered humanity. And then you get Adam and Eve, the man and the woman, Ish and Isha, a man and a woman, and that's another set of words. But to back to that question, I would say the short answer to that is, I understand and that chapter two is a drill down talking more about the apex of creation, the special creation of Adam and Eve.
Does that go along with the idea of the Hebrew circular storytelling?
Yes, the idea of drilling down in stories, it's a very Hebrew way of doing it. You and I would say we'd probably give that a C or C minus in creative writing class because we're very linear. It's like, you need to put that up at the beginning, right? God created male and female, and now have some bullet points and put chapter two in there. But no, it is a very common way of storytelling, and chapter two goes into more detail into the creation of humanity.
Why would God have created Adam and Eve with a need for them to have evolved?
So if you believe in evolution, you don't think God created Adam and Eve as Adam and Eve. Whether you're Darwinian, well, you don't even think of an Adam and Eve and Darwinian, but if you're intelligent design or theistic evolution, you believe that Homo sapiens evolved and there was a room of Homo sapiens. You are good-looking Homo sapiens. But there are a bunch of Neanderthals out here, right? And Adam and Eve are simply a pair that God picked out. This is the fundamental weakness of theistic evolution and intelligent design. It's very hard to reconcile this part of it with the biblical account.
Since you mentioned the Neanderthals, Do we have Neanderthal DNA?
I don't know about you guys, but do we have Neanderthal DNA? That is, yeah, that's kind of complicated. No. I'll just say no. Okay. For once, I'm going to be brief. My wife seems to approve. She put the mic down. That's good. Let me finish this, though, with one other question that I think. I just want you to think about this. So, there are several points I want to make in this. I do want you to understand the different views. I want you to understand the trade-offs of those views, that there are difficulties with them. I want you to understand that if you believe the Bible, then you will have some tension with current scientific theories. It's always been true. I personally can sleep just fine with a little tension. I don't have any problem with that. But if you want to include the current scientific theories and try to, if you're Darwinist, you don't need to harmonize it, but if you want to harmonize it, you've got some thinking to do about the authority of the Scripture and the truth of the Scripture. That's a difficult one. That's why I said the boat and the dock. There's some difficulties in that. But I wanted you to see the idea, though, that us having this discussion, we're Christians, here we are discussing evolutionary biology, that's fine. Think it through. God is not insecure about this, right? But the other thing is that there are implications for what people and what a society believes about origin. Morality is one of it. The biggest one, and this is at the root, the more you think, if you just go away and think about these two points, you will find a million examples where evolutionary ideology will lead you to a lot of things you see happening in our world, and biblical ideology will lead you to opposing those things and having a very different point of view. The question of what is a human is very easy if you believe that the Bible is true. A human being is the creation of God, in the image of God, of inestimable worth, created for a purpose, and everyone has dignity. You may do bad things, and we may put you in jail, but the fact that you are a human being is that it means you have value. Okay? That's the biblical view. Evolutionary view, it is hard to even define what a human is. You see that all the time in our culture. I don't know if you've thought about this, but think about this. This is just, I just pulled out some examples, so I'm not trying to be hard on anybody. This is the whole trans anything is this issue. This is transracial. You may remember her. She decided she was going to be a different race. This is transgender, meaning I decide that, what my gender is. In other words, I define that. It is not defined. I define what humans are. Evolutionary idea basically gives you the malleability of humans. In other words, a human is whatever we make a human to be. And this is where you get, this is a big deal right now, editing humanity. Gene splicing, gene editing, CRISPR technology, which is moved beyond that now. There's some better techniques. We can engineer babies. We can engineer the human race. Eugenics is back. Many of you may not remember that term, eugenics. Eugenics was an offshoot of evolutionary theory, and I'm not trying to just malign Charles Darwin, but if evolution is true, and it's survival of the fittest, and the best of humanity should win out, there were a group of people, there actually been a lot of groups of people, who thought that, well, in that case, if that's true, then we should engineer humanity. They didn't know how to edit genes, so you know what they did? I'm talking about Westerners, Easterners, definitely the Nazis. But this was British Empire, everybody. We can't create a better human, but we will cull the substandard humans out of the population. So there was forced sterilization. If you don't know about this, you need to read some history. This is a little over 100 years ago. As we are going to force sterilization for disabled people, mentally handicapped people, whatever. We are going to, in some cases, we will kill babies who are born imperfect so that we can breed and pursue our evolutionary goals of a better human race. This is eugenics, people. Now, instead of, we do still kill the ones we don't want, right? That's called abortion. But we can also edit them in the womb. And we are going to tweak the genes so that they will be taller, smarter, stronger, have straight white teeth, and get A's on their all their tests. This, if you're a Christian, you would have a certain point of view on this because you understand that humanity is defined by what God says it is. Evolution says humanity is whatever you can make it. Do you understand that? That's why this is happening. I'm just telling you there are implications of what you believe, and what we believe as a culture leads us to unbridled pursuit of a number of these things. Genetic modification, what is a human, and when is a human? That is fundamentally the abortion debate. That's the way it's crystallized today, is when does someone become a human being? Some would say at the moment of conception. We believe the Bible. Others would say that no, at the point of viability. Well, then others would say no, not until you're actually born. And others, and there are more and more of them, not until you're actually self-sufficient. Do you understand? These are current debates in our society. Those debates are happening because of what we think about who human beings are. So if this sounds philosophical, I'm really trying to bring it down to real things. I just want you to know that the debates that are happening, this is where they come from. So I don't want you to read what's going on in the world and say, what are people, what happened to people? What are they thinking? I'll tell you exactly what they're thinking. This is a very logical outgrowth of this point of view. The logical outgrowth of a biblical point of view is quite different on a number of these things. And you see our culture in tension around these ideas of where we came from. Okay? So, what you believe about where we come from matters. The truth matters. And consequently, it's important for us to advocate for human dignity. We are running on the fumes of our Christian past right now. The only thing that holds any of this up is the leftover belief that people have innate dignity. And that's a Christian belief, a Jewish belief as well, but I'm going to speak as a Christian. That's a Christian belief. But over time, as that goes away, people, you will see these kinds of things pick up pace. You will see more and more pressure to answer the question, what exactly does make us human? And are there any limits whatsoever on what we might do to each other or what we might do to improve ourselves? So these ideas really very much come from Genesis chapter 1. I know that sounds like a far-fetched, but now that you've heard all of this, you realize, you know what? Genesis chapter 1 is very profound. What you believe about that ends up on the front page of the news. It ends up in the babies of our world. It ends up in who gets to be born and who does not get to be born, who gets euthanized and who doesn't get euthanized. All of these things matter because of what you think about Genesis chapter 1. That's what's at stake in the idea of human origins. So what I would like for us to do is be very well informed, but what you think about this really does matter. What you think about this is going to shape your worldview on some extremely important issues in our time. That makes sense? I'm going to argue for you, I'm not going to do it right now, but I'm going to make this point to you. As a Christian who believes the biblical account, okay, but I also am very comfortable with science, but what I want to say to you is, as a Christian who believes in the dignity of humanity, I think that this culture is on a death spiral because this kind of ideology, this ideology that human beings are malleable and we define what they are, is a nihilistic idea. It is not good for society. If you know anything about the statistics in America today, you will realize that our young people are not doing well. This ideology is an ideology of death. Okay, end of commercial, but I want you to think about that. That's why our God is the God of life and the God of light. And this God is the one that loves you and gives you worth. Our young people need to hear that message, because that's not the message they're hearing here, is that you are expendable, you don't measure up, and if you aren't useful, we don't need you. That's not the message that we have. Now, I do want to acknowledge that the world is in a real bit of trouble. How does the creation account in the Bible explain the difficulty in the world today? If God created humanity and the sixth day, and he saw what he had created and it was very good, then how did we get to Minneapolis? That's what we'll talk about next time. I'll see you guys then.